from LPM,
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
Support for this podcast comes from KTC Building, seamlessly blending the classic character of older structures with 21st century amenities and technologies. Residential and commercial remodeling projects of any size. Details at KyleThompsonCompany.com.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. So, Doc, you know, the show Pose just ended its second season.
I know.
Phenomenal show.
I'm sad about it.
We have our sleepovers and watch it.
Yes.
We talk about it. And, of course, we love the show. But I think that the show has been really eye-opening for a lot of people who were previously unfamiliar, not just with ball culture, but also the nature of gay families and chosen families. Mm-hmm. And so I really am excited about today's guest, who wrote a piece spotlighting a gay family, a chosen family in the Philadelphia area. Please welcome to the show visual journalist and Lens Fest fellow from the Philly Inquirer, Heather Khalifa. Heather, how are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Phenomenal. Welcome to the show. So in your piece, the title of it is, of course, Brookhaven Couple Act as Stand-in Mom and Dad to LGBTQ Youth. In your story, we meet a couple, a trans woman and her fiancé, who have become surrogate parents to some 87 people. Who do we meet in your story, and how do you come to know these people?
So we met Andre and Doug, a group of us on the visual team had a meeting, and we wanted to do a project for Pride Month specifically. And we kind of asked around like different organizations and just like people we knew. And someone had recommended Andrea, who's really active in the LGBTQ community in like the Philly region. They said, sure, you know, you should have her on for a video idea that we had, which was to have like kind of intergenerational LGBTQ couples kind of meet and just talk about, you know, whatever, I guess, their lives and like love, finding love, etc. Just like a candid conversation on camera, which we did. But over the course of that interview, Andrea had mentioned like the House of L'Amour, and she sort of explained briefly what it was. And we were really interested in that. So I pursued it as like a print piece for the paper. So that's how we met them. And wonderful. We went to their house in Chester, you know, her family, and we had like, you know, a great conversation, and that's how the story really came about.
Now, she says that she is not, you know, her exact quote says, "I don't claim to be everybody's biological mother," but she talks mm-hmm. about being her children's spiritual mother. Elaborate for our audience, on what she meant by she serves as a spiritual mother to her house children.
Yeah, I think she. First of all, she prides herself. She keeps it real, as she always says. And she knows, like, she's not people's biological mother, but she gives them what they may need. So that was a big concept that she had explained, was that the House of L'Amour is, like, what people need from it. So for some people, it's literally, like, safety, you know, from living on the streets. Some people, like, their actual biological mothers don't speak with them, or they're not on good terms. And then some of them actually, you know, it's literally something as simple as like, I need someone to check in with me on like my birthday or a holiday, which to me was probably the most striking thing that she had explained when she was talking about the house, because I had never even thought of that. But she, you know, for her growing up, she said she never had family or like people checking in on her when it was a holiday or her birthday or something. So that's what she means when she says like she's their spiritual mother. Like, she will give them whatever it is that they need. And some of it is, you know, the things that maybe some of us have taken for granted from our parents when we grew up that other people did not have. And she gives that to them. Sometimes it's as simple as like picking out an outfit if they're going out at night or whatever it may be. She's there for them, essentially.
I love it. So Andrea, as we mentioned, Andrea is a black trans woman. She's 53. Her husband is, or her fiance is Doug. He's 50. Andrea's been in this since the 1980s when she first began opening up her home to children who are coming of age, and you know, and as you mentioned, can provide something simple as make them advice. And I really love the story you tell about one of her children saying that she was able to learn things like how to shave, right? Then Andrea says, as a cisgender woman, you can't teach your trans daughter about being a woman having a shave and then have a smooth face. And that's something that for most cisgender women, shaving is an anomaly. And for trans women, that's a reality. What is Andrea's relationship like with a lot of the people's birth parents? Like, to what degree has she met some of them or not met some of them? What's her relationship like with their birth parents?
Yeah, that's what I thought was interesting as well, is that for some, like, I don't know. I don't think she's in contact with some, but with others, you know, she would go out to dinner with them. Like, she had, I think, Tiffany, who's, like, one of the newer members of the home, she had gone out with, you know, her, and I'm not sure if it was both her parents, but definitely her father, who's actually the one who kind of recommended Andre to her. She said, you know, meet my daughter and, you know, help her out.
Yeah.
It kind of ranges. Like, for some, she's, you know, on speaking terms, goes out for dinner, and then others, I guess, maybe not. She doesn't really interact with them as much.
Yeah. How much of what they're doing at the House of L'Amour is revolutionary? Meaning that when we, in the article, you contextualize what's going on for LGBT youth, especially what's happening to Black trans women, right? So you mentioned that the 26th Black trans woman has been killed, and then also that queer and trans youth are disproportionately vulnerable to housing due to rejection of family, so on and so forth. So, you know, having this house, right, isn't just about providing a warm meal and, right, of advice about, you know, how to carry oneself, but it's also serving as a revolutionary type of safe haven in the midst of what's going on socially, politically, in the lives of many trans and queer youth, right?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I thought it was definitely enlightening for me to speak with the expert who I spoke with from Project Home in Philly, because she had sort of put into perspective to me a bit, saying that with, you know, for people in the LGBTQ community, it's, in a sense, it's not anything new to be looking out for one another, because, you know, as we know, like, just marginalized communities in general tend to look out for each other more because they have to. And so in that context, she felt like, she was like, you know, we hear stories like this, but, you know, on the other hand, she had also put into, I guess, for knowing, like, where we are in Philly, she's like, generally speaking, Philly tends to be a little bit more of a poor city, and homelessness in general, especially youth homelessness, it's higher than people would think. So I thought that was interesting too, just like putting into perspective where, like, in Philly and Chester. But yeah, I think what she does, like, this, you know, Andrea's scope of, like, how many children she has, you know, she has children internationally as well, she told us. I think that it makes her and her family unique, and just like how she keeps up with all of them. And, you know, they come and go, but they're still a family. And as she emphasized, they're not like a ballroom family or anything like that. They're just literally just a family. And that's it.
I love it. Well, thank you so much for writing this piece. I mean, I really certainly enjoyed reading, looking at the pictures of the House of L'Amour there in Westchester, and Andrea and her fiancé Doug are doing such wonderful work. So thank you so much for writing this piece, and we wish you the best of luck.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Take care. Bye-bye. All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we be.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. To support the work we do on Strange Fruit, visit donate.strangefruitpod.org. Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
All right, Doc. So there's all, you know, we obviously been watching the show Pose.
Yes.
And I think the show Pose has allowed a lot of people to understand the notions of, well, we've known for a very long time about, especially Black and brown queer families, aka houses. You know, we, of course, have the House of Pedagogy, which is our academic and social activism house, which has the your kids and my kids, those who are social activists and academics, et cetera. And, of course, I'm in the ballroom scene, the House of Prestige. The hippies have families, but so the notions of, like, chosen families have been around.
A group of human beings in a mutual bond.
Yes, as they say in Paris is Burning. But yes. So that's one version, right, of how people do this parenting, mentorship kind of thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But you very rarely hear gay people, lesbian people, trans people say the word mentor in particular, right?
That's true.
That's my gay child, right? That's my gay niece, right? Yes, yeah. You know, that's, you know, but they very rarely say mentor. And I don't mean like in an academic context, like you and a student, but I mean like a young person who's just in your life that you're their mentor. And so I wonder, like, what is the reluctance for intergenerational mentoring? You know, there's so much to unpack here, of course. Like, what does it mean? You know, first of all, I think the gay male culture is very youth-obsessed.
Yeah.
Certainly there's some deep-rooted, internalized kind of homophobic things that we all hold about the notion of if we're allowed or not allowed to be friends with people from a different generation. But anyway, to help us make sense of all that about LGBTQ intergenerational mentoring and more, please welcome to the show writer James Jim Finn. Jim, how are you?
I'm great today. Thanks so much for asking me to talk with you.
Yeah, we are so delighted to have you. So you wrote an essay for Medium.com about your relationship with a young person. Now, you describe yourself as being in your 50s. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes, I am 57.
All right, 57. So, yes. And
a little bit more than that old 60 than 50, but we'll still take.
Yeah, that's okay. I'm closer to 40 than 30, so I'm right behind you, buddy. But you opened your piece talking about a friend of yours who recently turned 21. Who is this friend to you? What is the relationship to you? And then why were you reluctant to write this piece about mentorship?
Well, this friend of mine is somebody that I came to know as a writer online several years ago when he was 18. He was a first-year uni student, a university student in southern England, and I was motivated to contact him. He wrote something about consciousness. He wrote something about spirituality that really connected with me about how all of us are stardust and how we're – something about how we're all really just the universe briefly becoming aware of itself through us. And that touched me, and I sent him a message on the writing platform, and I said, you know, that's really cool. And so I checked out some more of his writing. He checked out mine, and I had made a mistake. I thought he was someone else. I thought he was an older person that I had conflated with his identity on that writing platform. And it took me several days to realize that I was occasionally chatting back and forth with an 18-year-old, and then. You know, an out gay 18-year-old. And frankly, it set me back. When I realized that I had made that mistake, I thought, oh my gosh, here I am, a middle-aged gay man, you know, like hooking up on social media, not hooking up in the biblical sense, obviously, but chatting on social media with a teenager. And I felt weird about that. And then I started thinking about it and I thought, no, I shouldn't feel weird about that. It's not right that I should feel weird about that because we're having these really productive exchanges. I'm learning a little bit from him as he talks to me about his university experiences, and he's asking me about my experiences with what it's like to be a gay man in today's world. And it was all productive and it was cool. And I put my thoughts aside, I put my reservations aside, and I said, well, clearly this mentoring relationship, this friendship is meant to be, so we're just going to let it be. And that's how it started.
You mentioned in the essay, Jim, that your hesitation came out of these entrenched societal stereotypes that oftentimes position middle-aged gay men as sexual threats to younger gay men. Can you talk briefly to our audience about where these stereotypes come from and are rooted in, and or talk about if maybe this was your hesitation or reservations around it had something to do with you personally and your lived experience as maybe a young gay man and seeing older gay men as predatory or so on and so forth?
Yeah, well, to begin with, I absolutely think that my reservations were rooted in that. I don't think that gay people and straight people are very different in how we view youth. I mean, especially in our culture today, youth is clearly highly prized, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we see it on television, we see it in the movies, any kind of pop culture, and gay men are no exception. So sure, sometimes we find younger guys to be attractive and desirable, but we're taught from the moment that we start growing up as young same-sex attracted people, as queer people, we swim in this ocean of toxins constantly, and we internalize this idea that we should be ashamed of our attractions. Even when we reject it intellectually, so I think what happens, you know, a lot of straight men will sort of acknowledge to themselves, yes, this younger woman is attractive, and I can acknowledge that to myself, but I experience my attraction, I experience my sexuality as positive. And so I know that I can acknowledge that attraction to myself and then put it in a box that says it's got nothing to do with me personally, and it's healthy. But gay men have more trouble doing that, in my experience. Because first of all, one of the tropes that we have to put up with as we grow and as we come out and as we swim in these oceans of toxins is that something about our attraction in and of itself is inherently not healthy. Mm. And that when it's especially directed toward young people, then not only is it not healthy that we're experiencing it, but we're infecting them with it. Because what is it that people who object to homosexuality, who object to queerness, what's one of their primary objections? Mm-hmm. Is that we're corrupting youth, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you're right. You mentioned your piece that when you think about drag queen story hours at the libraries, right? Yeah. Oh my God, the outrage! You know, transgender kids, kids transition. Oh my God, the kids! You know, like books in school in high school that have gay characters. Oh my God, the kids! And you're right. You say that LGBT people have a constant messaging about how we're threats to young people, and so I love you say we must rise above the shame. So I want to ask you what. Yes. So how did you begin to your young person? Your friend's name is Fred, correct?
Yes. Fred Shirley.
Shout out to Fred. What's up, Fred in the UK? But
hey,
was it for you, Jim, to overcome that? There was a lot of internal talk, but how easy or difficult was it for you to overcome those reservations? And were you also candid with Fred about like, yo, I really enjoy this our friendship, you know, but I have these reservations, and or this something that you kind of process on your own?
You know, we actually did have a fairly embarrassing WhatsApp exchange about that.
Yeah.
He had sent me some sort of a message. I don't even remember what it was anymore. And I took it as flirtation. And I overreacted to it. And I shouldn't have for all the reasons I just explained to you, you know. But I did. I had a strong internal reservation about the message that he sent me. And I instantly just messaged him back. Listen, I don't mean any offense by this, Fred, but you cannot flirt with me. That's just a line that we cannot cross if we value our friendship. And, you know, I was very proud of myself for saying that. And I was wrong to say it, because his immediate response was, flirting? What are you talking about? I wasn't flirting with you, old man.
So he said, flirting? What do you mean? And so what was your response?
And so my response was, well, I'm glad we've got this out in the air. Because, you know, you're a fascinating guy, and I would really enjoy, you know, continuing to have a friendship mentoring relationship. But as long as we had this embarrassing incident, let's just understand that, you know, there's no, that there's no sexual tension and that and all of that.
glad you got that out of the way. Good.
Right. And it was more embarrassing for me because he was on that page all along.
Yeah.
He already understood that. So it wasn't him. It was me. I had the problem. He didn't have the problem. And I think that's one of the problems that a lot of us older gay men have. And that's why I wrote the article. You know, we avoid mentoring relationships because we internalize our homophobia, and it's just easier for us to avoid the relationships and avoid the negativity that they might inspire in us than to confront the difficulty and take the plunge.
No, certainly. So you've been in this kind of mentor-mentee friendship with Fred for a couple of years now. Talk to our guests a little bit about you all's exchanges. What kind of advice is he asking of you? What kind of advice are you offering? So on and so forth. Like, let us get into the dynamic of you and Fred.
Sure.
And how the relationship works for y'all.
Because you mentioned that it's a two-way street. Right. So are there things that you learned from him as well?
It's absolutely a two-way street. I've learned a tremendous amount from him. If I can just brag on Fred for a minute, he has just turned 21, and he is entering a master's program in physics next year at Bristol University, and he'll be doing his research at CERN in Geneva. So,
oh, wow. Amazing.
Here we go. Give it up, Fruitcake.
Go friend. Go friend. Wow.
Yes.
I mean, so he's a brilliant young man. So, I mean, and exceptionally so. And besides that, he's quite the artist and photographer. So we really do have a lot to talk about. I've been able to sharpen my mind, you know, against his. And you asked me what I've been able to do. I think if we take it back to the first few months of our friendship, when he was a first-year university student at Bristol and living away from home for the first time, and he was out to some of his friends, but he wasn't out to the world. He certainly wasn't out to the family. And he wanted to meet, but he didn't know how. I mean, he literally didn't know how to start the conversation with his parents. And it worried him, and it stressed him out. And so what I was able to do over the course of several weeks was help him practice. Well, so this is what, these are some of the ways that young people come out. These are some of the things that you can say to your parents. And so not only did I give him real practical advice about how to do that, but, you know, I gave him moral support as well. He wanted to come out to his parents. He knew that his parents were going to accept him intellectually, but he didn't have the emotional strength to take the first steps. And so I helped him with that.
I love it. I love it. I love it. Let me ask you this. Who is Auntie Jimothy and what does she do for the people?
Okay. So I'm glad you asked. I write on medium.com. I have a blog there and I write a really eclectic selection of things. A lot of it is LGBTQ history and the history of activism. I write a lot of rants, very educated rants, I think, about current events, about the Equality Act, about equality, about, in fact, I'm currently writing a series of letters to Christian leaders about reevaluating theology, reevaluating faith in terms of human knowledge, and in terms of accepting LGBTQ people as human beings, you know, fully deserving of dignity and love. But in between all of that very serious writing that I do, I write an advice column for youth, Dear Auntie Jimothy. And I play the part of a campy occasional drag queen giving advice to teenagers and young adults. And Fred was my inspiration for starting that. So my latest column was a young woman who wrote in about how she's non-binary. She identifies mostly as a woman, but as gender fluid. And she's having terrible problems in her real life, you know, not online trans support group. And in her online trans support group, she's having a hard time dealing with stress from people who reject her identity.
Yeah.
And so we talked about that a little bit in the column. Here's one. I don't want to kiss my maybe boyfriend. A gay teen wrote in and said, you know what? I've got this boyfriend for the first time. And I think that we're really tight. But you know what? I feel grossed out by kissing him. And I don't want to kiss him. Is that all right?
I love it. So this functions as the advice and sex column.
Yeah, it's like
and...
almost like a Dear Abby, except drag queen. I live.
Yeah.
It's almost like Dan Savage-ish in a way.
Okay, yes.
It's not quite as out there, because I'm really focusing on younger people and I'm not, you know, trying to go in exactly as much for the more explicit sexual questions.
Yeah. In the piece at the toward the bottom or end of your piece, Jim, you talk about how you're very proud that you have functioned in Fred's life as a mentor, and you encourage others to begin to unravel and unlearn some of the, you know, stereotypes they might hold and prejudices that they might internalize so they can also mentor. And you say it's up to gay men to own our own manhood and our own masculinity, however we choose to define masculinity. It's up to us to own our nurturing sides and not be ashamed of them, right? Where you're encouraging your reader to explore their misconceptions and internalize prejudices. Can you talk to us about if anyone has reached out to you because of the piece and said that they've thought seriously about mentorship or not, or explain to our readers what, you know, kind of masculinity and those things have to do with being a mentor? Why do they need to kind of assert or unlearn certain aspects of masculinity in order to be effective mentors?
Yes, and oh my gosh, what an incredibly complex question.
Sorry.
No, it's quite all right. Because it all gets down into the roots of internalized homophobia itself. I mean, as gay men and as queer people, we're different in terms of how we often we're different in terms of how we express our gender. We reject certain social ways of being, and some of us are really out there. I mean, I'm not particularly. I guess I have a little bit of a fey lilt in my voice once in a while, but I can generally pass. You know what I mean? If I want to.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Which is not all that often, but if I want to, and some of us can't. There are some very confusing lines drawn between sexual orientation and gender identity. Not to say that they're not two separate things. They are, but there's a flux. And so when it comes to gay male communities, now we run into some real viper's nests of social problems, because many gay men are ashamed of femininity. And I'm not blaming them for that, nor am I saying, lest anybody get the wrong idea, that gay men have to be feminine. Understand. But it's a thing. It's real. There is a sense of gender rebellion among many gay men. And there is that subset of gay men, for whatever scientific reason or biological reason may exist, who find themselves to be innately feminine in whatever way it is that society defines that. You understand what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So it happens, but we get this rejection. We get these traditional gay male communities where masculinity is highly prized, where muscularity is highly prized, where the feminine is looked down on, even as it still exists as part of the community. And we tie ourselves in knots and we tear ourselves apart trying to deal with all of that dissonance. And I find that is something else that leads to a problem with mentorship, because we can't own our own masculinity. We can't own our own sense of gender presentation, because in some cases we're ashamed of ourselves. In some cases, we're ashamed of our peers. In some cases, we just don't know what the hell we think. And because we can't own who we are, because we can't be truly out and proud, because something inside of us is whispering and won't let us be, then we're in no position to be able to relate to younger people who need role models.
Yeah, absolutely.
We can't be that role model because we can't be that role model for ourselves.
That makes total sense, Jim. I'll tell you what, mm-hmm. Well, we have enjoyed hearing from you on this topic. I also understand that you describe yourself as a former activist, but you were quite active with ACT UP NYC and Queer Nation. So I want to thank you, from a 30-something to a 50-something, thank you for clearly the activism that you've done over the years, HIV activism, LGBTQ activism, you know, for the betterment of the entire society. Thank you for not only doing that work, but then also being willing to mentor folk and pass on that knowledge. So that means a lot to us, not just to have you as a guest, but we're really honored as a person to have you as someone who's done so much, but mm-hmm. continues to get back on our show. So it's a real delight.
No, thank you so much, Jim.
Oh, and thank you so much for asking me. As I said, I was so pleased when I got your email, and I really enjoyed the opportunity.
Let people know, let our listeners know how they can find your writing online.
Yeah, you can find me at medium.com/James-Finn, F-I-N-N, medium.com/James-Finn.
That's right. Listeners, you can go there and read lots of Jim's wonderful writings. Also visit Auntie Jimothy Child and read her writings as well.
Yes.
Jim, we wish you the best of luck. Please take care and come back anytime.
And thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Bye-bye. All right, Doc, what a wonderful show today. I'm really, really appreciative to both our guests, to Jim, but also to reporter Heather Khalifa, for sharing with us really two wonderful examples of how folk are mentoring LGBT young people. Mm-hmm. We have the story of the Lamore family in Philadelphia, which had the more traditional, as we know it, kind of house structure, barroom family structure.
Yeah.
But then also what it means for someone who isn't necessarily of that scene to very be very intentional about being a mentor, right? Who wouldn't necessarily call himself a gay father,
yeah.
but also very functioning quite the same way, would you say?
Yeah, and I really appreciated how thoughtful Jim was about kind of pulling out all of the nuances and
yes.
the reluctancy that might
Unpacking
be behind,
all that shit, yeah.
you know, gay folk of a particular age, mentoring young folk and what that relationship would look like and what the boundaries of that relationship would entail. I really yeah. appreciated it.
Do you ever, because obviously you're a professor and obviously students look to you for mentorship either on campus and also because we're both so visible as Black queer people in the city, that we oftentimes have young people, you know, drawn to us. And do you ever feel, well, for me, it's not all so uneasy because I feel like I'm too old to be their friend, but part of me feels like I'm still young too. So they look at us as if we're elders. And I'm finally deciding, not, and I've decided a couple weeks ago that I'm finally going to embrace the notion of an elder, right? And it's not being an elder is not a bad thing.
Okay.
It means you earned your stripes and you have knowledge to share. So do you ever feel any sense of unease about mentoring or being in a relationship with young people that way? Or because you're a woman, perhaps you think that maybe those same kind of expectations about a lecherous relationship. You know how he was talking about how gay men are taught that,
yeah,
you know,
like I know that
maybe some romance. Do women have that same kind of, lesbians have the same kind of thing or no?
I don't think so. I don't think that there's any kind of predatory nature associated with women, period. I mean, you do have this kind of lesbian predator as an icon in film.
But it's almost celebrated.
But
kind
yeah,
of, yeah,
I mean, and it's kind of, yeah, like has a certain type of allure.
Comedic or, yeah.
Yeah, because it's like she's a predator to like consenting age
yes.
who really are really down for it type of straight
yeah.
women in suburbia.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's kind of when you see that stereotype or, you know, something like that. But I don't think it's that. I think that if anything, it's the opposite. I think that kids tend to flock to folks who either identify as feminine or exhibit feminine behavior because they see nurturing and nurturing
yeah.
in these
yeah.
regard as some kind of natural and innate thing. So I've always been a kind of reluctant mentor in those
yeah.
ways because of the gendered expectation yeah. around like, oh, well, you should do it or you're probably better at it or you're probably more loving at it or whatever the assumptions are because
you're a woman.
Yeah, because I'm a woman and then because I'm a lesbian and all these kinds of things. So I've never really I'm reluctant in that way for it where I'm going to be strict in terms of the boundaries, in terms of my time.
Yeah. And who you even accept kind of as this, like, a gay
yeah,
child.
Yeah, because I don't want everybody in the street talking about, yeah, that's
my
mentor.
My
you know?
Yeah,
yeah, I feel like I'm allowed to
yeah,
be, yeah, to pick and choose. And I think that a mentor and mentee relationship, similar to what Jim was talking about, requires consent on both sides.
Yeah.
I mean, what was happening to me, especially when I first get to U of L, was that folks were saying that I was their mentor and they had never even taken my class. And I'm like, girl, no.
Yeah,
and I'm like, child, we've never even had a single conversation. And,
yeah.
and I don't even know how you're operating or moving in this world to be having you associated with my name.
Me, yeah.
yeah, so my name means something too. So it's no
yeah.
shade, but I feel like the mentor-mentee relationship should be one
reciprocal.
Yeah,
kind of
and not a like kind of a have to and a duty. I think it's something that is extra. I think it's on top of whatever professional job or work you're already doing.
Yeah.
And because it can be taxing and because it can require a lot of emotional labor, it should be something that's consensual for both parties.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
It should be beneficial in
yeah.
a lot of ways for both parties. So any mentee I've ever had, anybody I've ever said, you're my child, I've learned tremendously from them.
Yeah.
I enjoy them. I have fun with them. And it doesn't feel like work. It doesn't feel like an extra and it doesn't feel like a burden. And I think that that's the way in which I kind of imagine
yeah.
the
yeah.
mentor-mentee relationship. So I really was appreciative of Jim talking about and exploring him and Fred's, you know, mentor-mentee
yeah.
relationship.
I love it. All right. Well, shout out to our guests today. Thank you all so much. And listeners, shout out to you as always.
Yes.
It's always a delight to spend these 30 to 45 to an hour with y'all. Please continue to give us your feedback on things you're enjoying. If you have ideas for the show, perhaps you want to be a guest on the show, we'd love to have you all make your pitch to us. I promise we're really, you know, it's pretty easy to get on the show. I will say, no, it's not
no.
all that easy. But, no, but we really do appreciate y'all listeners. But for now, we're out of time. So, Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody. Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Kojin Toshiro.
For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.